Lovely. Wow, amazing. All right. Let's see here. Hello.
Ah, good. Okay. Managed to get through whatever thicket of permissions there were there finally.
Excellent. Glad you're here.
Glad to be here. I somewhat unadvisedly chose to install a full range of updates about 20 minutes before we started, which was probably not the best idea, but
Hey, now at least you're fully updated.
Seem to have made it through the wire, and anyway, yeah, fully updated before the next one.
Yeah, nice. So I'm just seeing if I am recording things on my side.
So you're getting sound okay from me?
I am. At some parts, I hear your breath in the microphone.
Oh, okay.
Is that something that you can do anything about?
I was lifting the mic up to my mouth, so it's probably unnecessary.
Ah, okay, great. Yeah, now it's not there, so lovely.
More sensitive than I thought.
Yeah, I see a friend of mine, Nikki, has joined us in the audience. Thanks for being there, Nikki. And yeah, I believe the space itself is being recorded, so we'll have that, and then I can share that so that it could be listened to in the future as well.
Okay, bro.
Great. So up for starting?
Sure. Well, AI, what was the comment that provoked it? It was Pedro Domingos post saying that about power requirements
Yes.
for AI as opposed to the brain. And how it indicated that something's wrong.
Yeah, that's right. I've gone so much into your various different things that you've written in so many places that I was like, yeah, where did this start? So,
Same thing.
but yeah, one of the things when it comes to power, that I saw you wrote was about the efficiency difference between current models and the brain, because the brain can run on a sandwich. And I was like, yeah. It's like, that's a pretty good
Well,
way of thinking about it.
exactly. So you can see why I was triggered by Pedro's post, because it was pretty much one of my talking points.
What was Pedro's post?
He was saying that the power requirements of AGI of current tech
I don't know where you can find it, actually. let me just go back to some notes I made earlier today. Right, cool. And where was his post? Actually, when we were chatting the other day, by text, X, Twitter was incredibly slow. So I was kind of hoping the update might speed that up. Let's see if I can find.
Well, if you go off of your own memory of it, because I think you know the topic really well. Was he saying that the systems, like, they don't require that much power and therefore it can just scale to AGI?
No, completely the opposite. Yeah. No, I understood it to be pretty much the same as my talking point, that there's clearly something wrong. It's just absurd. You know, we're talking, I heard what Sam Altman's talking about. I don't know what happened to his request for 7 trillion to build, Trump is talking about, doubling the power generation capacity of the US, which is nice in itself, but for the purpose of AI, which is all right too, but it's just like, you know, doubling the power requirement of the country or the world, because AI requires as much power as everything else combined. Yeah. It seemed, you know, rather than spending 7 trillion on that, I would rather that perhaps, like, you know, 0.01% of that be spent on a little bit of research to understand why, why AI doesn't actually, why intelligence, requires so little power.
Right. In researching your work, one of the common grounds I found between your perspectives and my own was this notion of power not determining truth. That seemed to be a very foundational baseline of how, I'm not sure if this is the wording you would use, but like how thinking happens or how processing reality happens.
Well, the power, I mean, so it's kind of a different tangent, you know. I had an interesting path because, I'm born and grew up in New Zealand, but I've spent large part of my life in Asia, and I was studying language. So I've been studying language from a long way back.
When you say and language, you mean like literal, like human language, right? You're not talking about like some programming language or something.
Well, both. I mean, like, I think growing up in New Zealand, you're so isolated in New Zealand. I was fascinated by the idea of language when I was a child. Because I couldn't imagine, what another language would be. You know, it's like,
interesting
to have the thoughts in my, you know, the thoughts in my head to me were as much a part of me as an arm or a leg. And the idea that anybody could exist without those echoes in their mind. I was like, well, what's in their mind? What's it like not to have these thoughts, but to have thoughts that are another shape?
Right.
And, so I was fascinated by it from an early age. I mean, if I'd grown up in a sort of a polyglot community, I probably would be, oh yeah. you meet people in Europe and they say, oh, it's a pain in the neck, all these different languages. But for me, it was fascinating. So I was motivated by that, and so I was studying language. I was motivated by just to know what that felt like, and also having a technical background, I was also interested to know how that worked. So then I got a job working on machine translation. So that kind of crystallized that. Into something very concrete.
When you were a kid, and you only had English, I presume, right?
Yeah.
That's in New Zealand. That's what they speak.
Well, I mean, the Polynesian language of New Zealand, Maori, has been pushed a lot since then. So you get a lot of that being pushed. But yeah, I mean, it's still mostly a monolingual
society. So when you were a kid though, so you only had this one language, what got it? Cause I was imagining that there's so many people that grew up in societies with only one language, but I've never heard of people have this thought or curiosity of, oh, what must it be like to think in these different shapes? Right. Dude, so it's I've never heard that before. Have you heard that?
Are there that many cultures isolated? So isolated. I mean, most people used to grow up in a monoculture of some kind. But not perhaps so isolated. You think of people growing up in England, well, maybe they, you know, French people might come into contact with French people more often, or it's quite easy. They're quite close. I mean, I suppose going back, living in villages where nobody went from one village to another.
I mean, you had other people around you, right, who were also in the same culture as you, same type of language structure as you. Did you find that they were also curious about this sort of thing too?
Well, I suppose not everybody's the same, no. So not
yeah, that's what I mean. So it's like, or yeah, like there's more to it than just the environment that would lead to that sort of it's a very specific curiosity, actually. It's super specific. That's
right. I mean, but you know, people grow up and they become curious about all sorts of things. And I'm of a curious nature. I mean, when I went through formal study, focused on physics, and physics, the reason for studying physics is because you understand how the hell the world works. And so I guess there was this like how the hell things work, gene that was working.
Yeah. I guess I was just wondering, was there like someone specific you met for the first time that like you were like, oh, or you saw on TV or something that spoke a different language? You're like, oh, I wonder if they think in this different way or something.
I obviously became aware of other languages. Otherwise I wouldn't have been fascinated by it. But, I mean, I don't think I met anybody who, you know, I had an uncle who was Dutch heritage, he was reading stories to his son in Dutch and that sort of thing, and I thought, that's cool. But I never met any. I clearly remember the first time in my life that I physically met someone who could not speak English.
Right.
And that was, I was about 18 years old, and Japanese tourists were just starting to visit New Zealand at that time. And I just, you know, some Japanese man asked me a question, and the communication was difficult. So, yeah,
right.
My fascination was earlier than that. I mean, I can't push it back. But I must have been about 8 years old, and I was fascinated by what it would be to speak another language.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Yeah.
So there was that. So I'm saying it's both, and then I became interested in the how it worked.
Yes.
Originally I wasn't, because I remember having somebody telling me about a talk on the radio, Noam Chomsky, of all people, he was talking about his theories of the theory of grammar, and I was not interested. I remember clearly at that time thinking, well, I don't really care. I just want to know what it feels like. I became interested in that too. So I had the fascination with language, and then I was working for a company. I got employed by a company that was doing machine translation. So that was something I needed to do. That came down to then learning grammar. And so, you know, what are the nuts and bolts of language? Well, I guess that's grammar. So what's grammar and how does grammar work? And I was trying to learn grammar. That's a long story to how I came to truth equating to power, because I became convinced that grammar was contradicted. Grammar could not be learned because language was full of contradictions. And when you learned patterns of grammar, you found that you had these patterns that would one way sometimes, another way another time.
Yes.
And it was just not possible to, wasn't possible to codify it completely and precisely.
Yeah.
And so this became my big thing that I was like, well, we can't learn grammar. We have to accept that that truth actually is, contradicts. That in one way it's like this and the other way it's like, and that fit with my physics background, because I was like, well, that's a bit like an uncertainty principle in physics. Oh, it's funny that's working sort of the same way. So I was like, oh, maybe some of the maths is the same. But it became my big thing that it's like, we can't learn grammar. We have to accept that that truth contradicts, right? And so that's got to be a fundamental part of how we're trying to do model intelligence on computers. And this was in Asia. And then I would come back to the West and notice odd things happening in the West. In different ways, but in terms of the truth is power thing, especially when woke started to sort of impinge on everybody's consciousness, and then I heard this connection with postmodern philosophy that truth is contradictory, that there is no it's constructed, and that because anything can be true, that just depends on the power of this group or that group to impose their interpretation. So yeah. Truth is power. So I was like, far out. It's like, you know, this thing that's been my thing that I've been pushing for so long, that truth is contradictory, is actually destroying society. So it was just an amusing collision of something that I'd come to privately, but from the opposite direction. I was coming from a direction of saying, "Oh, I can see how this happens."
So can I flesh this out with you? Because like how you got to it is not like a logical step in my eyes, but clearly I've gotten to a similar place, but from a very different angle. So I actually would love to map out with you how you got to where you got to.
Sure. I got there bottom up. I mean, I got there because I was looking at language and saying, well, you know, what's the structure of language and how do the rules of language work? And so I'm going to learn the rules. So I learned the rules and then I said, well, this rule is different from that rule. So I was actually creating contradictions from first principles. There was no mystery about it in the sense that you learn these things and they contradict. whereas what I ran into from the philosophical point of view was just the postmodernists were coming at it from the other direction. They were saying, well, we're seeing that we can't really pin down the truth of this or that. We don't know why it would be a contradictory. We can't see any system at all. So it must just be depend on who has the most power to impose their own design.
Yeah, like truth is determined by the person with the biggest stick.
Yeah, yeah. So which was sort of consistent with what I was seeing, but it was like from a completely different perspective because I could see that it clearly was not. Did not depend on how big your stick was. It was like it depended on the context and what was relevant information at a given moment.
If we were to have some kind of a first principles approach to grammar itself, because grammar is a it's like a couple layers up from physics because it's got to work through humans, it's got to work through history. The reason why there are contradictions, as far as I can see, in grammar is because grammar is like a thing made up by like people. And when you have people from different tribes who use language in different ways and then they mesh, they literally it would make sense why there would be contradictory basis for their rulemaking. Does that make sense?
So you're saying it would contradict because the different cultures would contradict.
Yeah, language is in some ways very arbitrary, as far as I understand it.
Well, it certainly proliferates and changes and mutates. And I see it the other way, actually. You're saying it's two stages away from base reality, because you've got the physical and then you've got the intellectual. But I see it differently. I see that we don't have access to anything except through our own cognition. So cognition is at the bottom, and above cognition comes physics, actually, because it's like, what physics? Physics is our observations. And then, so we're constructing a model for the world on top of what we observe. But if you don't have a model for how you observe things, then you can't observe them. So, for me, it's absolutely fundamental. And the contradictions are, if we have contradictions in language, it means that we have contradictions in our thinking.
Yes.
So it puts the contradictions. Well, I wouldn't say it puts them right at the very basis, but it puts them below everything else that humans can do. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that the universe is contradictory, but yes, whatever humans try to apply to the universe appears to involve contradiction.
Yes, absolutely.
So humans are trying to structure it in some ways. Humans are trying to simplify the universe so that they can benefit from it and not suffer from it.
Sure.
And those constructions, do appear to contradict on whatever level I can see to look at them. But it becomes most clear when you're looking at language, because I think conclusion I came to was that language is kind of special, because it's something. It's a perception. So, I mean, I think this happens for all of our perceptions. So for vision and even sound, that sort of thing. But, language is a perception that we create. So I think that it's a window into the way the brain is putting things together.
Yes. Absolutely.
And that's why I think that studying language is where you come to these contradictions most easily. That's one reason why I think that large language models, the LLMs, have caused this sudden leap change advance. I don't think it's by accident. I think that the language problem sort of pulls you there unawares, and I think the field doesn't really understand what's happened when it started studying language.
Yeah, that was a repeated pattern of the things you had written in so many different places, that we just don't understand why there is a sudden leap now in our ability to make progress.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think we've stumbled around for decades. You look at the history of AI for 70 years, really, but look at, so neural networks, it's ridiculous. You know what I mean? They stumbled around, and then NVIDIA made good GPU cards for people to play video games, and then it's like, oh, we can use this for, and then it just turned out that by accident that was useful for people modeling things on neural networks, and oh, the neural networks seem to do interesting things all of a sudden. Oh, and then it's like, oh well, so we've got neural networks, and it's like, oh well, how do you apply it to language? It's like, oh. You apply it to language and something really interesting happens. Nobody knows why. They're all just sort of playing around and, putting a computer game hardware to use, and things happen by accident. And I think that now that we've got this big surprise when we suddenly, when we started using studying the language problem with large language models, As soon as it works, people say, "Oh, that's good." But the next step is obviously not to look at the language problem. So everybody trying to do something new, they're saying, "Oh, well, we need to look at other data. We need to stop studying language to make the next advance." And it just seems crazy to me, because I think that this advance has been because you started looking at language and it's led you to this solution. You don't see the solution and you think that the way to solve the next set of problems is to stop looking at language. So, I describe that as language worked. So let's try something else.
Yes. We found something that works. So we need to move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Let's not do that anymore.
What is the next thing that is being moved on to then? Is it just increasing the computational power?
Other data. People are saying, Jan Le Quin is sort of prominent in pushing for, real world data. I don't know what he's calling it. Physical data, world models. I think it's world models that he's talking about. They're saying, you know, like language has all this tacit knowledge and does not have all this tacit knowledge that our intelligence can access. So in order to, it's obviously everybody that they can't reason very well. And so people are saying, to make them reason, we need to give them proper knowledge. Right. And so, I mean, that's crazy because they don't realize that language is what language is teaching us is that you need to move, that we can't structure things unambiguously. You know, I mean, AI started with attempts to structure things unambiguously with symbolic systems and logic.
What do you mean by unambiguously? Can you define that word for me?
There's a single truth. There's a single, you can abstract things so that, that you have a rule which applies in all situations. You make a law or you make a mathematical model. So mathematics is unambiguous. Yeah. If you have ambiguity in mathematics.
Ah, yes.
Then it's a disproof of whatever your theorem was.
Right.
From the beginning, we've been trying to, the general opinion is that you don't want ambiguity. You want to have certainty.
Sure.
And so people started from certainty with symbolic systems and logic. And then it's like, well, this is certain. So this is going to give us, you know, we just need to apply this and we'll figure out how intelligence works. And well, that didn't work. And then it's like, so they sort of took a step back from certainty and statistical systems, because became the mainstream. And then, so in the 90s, you move from symbolic systems to statistical systems, which, you know, have probablistic models. We don't know for sure, but most of the time this seems to work. And then through the noughties, the tens, Bayesian statistics was the default model of artificial intelligence. Massive online, open ML. Online course, which was, teaching about AI, which came out, I think, 2010 or 2011, Stanford, like somebody, had an AI course. And it was all Bayes. It was all Bayesian statistics. It didn't mention connectionism at all. So this was 2010-ish or so. So, you know, you've got AI is symbolism. And then in the 90s, it sort of moves to statistics because it works better for things like speech recognition. And you've got some speech recognition sort of working about 1997. Some companies started. Bill Gates gave a theme note address talking about how computers would be talking, I think, in 1997. I remember Comdex. So statistics worked a bit better. And then in the noughts, Bayesian statistics, it was all Bayesian statistics. And then, with GPUs, you had neural networks explode on the scene about 2011. But it's like, well, why? So you go from symbolism to statistics to networks. And at each step, it's a movement away from abstraction. But people are certain, people are still convinced that they're trying to abstract everything. So what are they trying to do with the neural networks? They're trying to learn abstractions. Right? So it's like, well, we're finding these abstractions, but that's funny that the more distributed and the less focused our systems are, the better they get. But we're gonna learn those abstractions. So neural networks are we're all about. They started with supervised learning, where you would show your system a lot of examples of the abstraction you wanted it to learn. And then there was unsupervised learning. So it's all about learning abstractions. Where the system would automatically learn some of these abstractions which were going to be universally applicable. And then you come to language models, and I think what happened with language models is that they are the final step away from abstraction, because you not only give up on symbolism, there's no symbolism in a model, people complain about that, and it's not probabilistic, you don't even have, trying to supervise the learning in any way, you don't provide it with examples. Because with language, the problem moves completely away from abstraction, it becomes prediction. And it liberates, I mean, from the way I'm understanding it, it's the final step away from abstraction. You've got no abstractions anymore.
Can you define abstraction here?
Well, the same thing.
Prediction? Yeah.
So abstraction is compression, or it's taking a lot of things and unifying them. So it's like saying, well, you know, you've got a lot of individuals, they're all humans, and you've got, you know, so it's like a human being is an abstraction of individual humans, or you've got planets are an abstraction of all these lumps of rock around and that sort of thing. So you try and reduce an infinity of variation to be like to get to the essence of it. So that's what people are convinced we're doing when we're doing artificial intelligence, is getting to the essence of meaning, abstracting the mess of a messy reality to be.
The function of abstracting is that it lets you essentially talk about very large amounts of information using very few words.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. It means you can interact with an infinite universe with a finite mind, I suppose you'd say.
Yeah. I suppose the word infinite is the biggest abstraction then.
Well, that's right. I mean, if we didn't have that word, we wouldn't be able to, we certainly can't conceive it.
But, you would have the longest run on sentence ever. It's like, well, there is the paper and the rocks and
everything's in it. And so, I think this has been the lesson of language, but I think it's been ignored. What's happened after that? So you get to this final stage of completely dumping of symbolism and abstraction, and you're just like, oh, we're just going to do prediction of the sequence, and we're not going to imagine there's any kind of abstraction there at all. And it works best. And so what's people's reaction to that? They're saying, oh yeah, but we really need abstraction in this. And where are we going to find the abstraction? Oh, the abstraction must be in the world. It must be in real world data. We need to have all this, exposure to vision and real objects. And that's where we're going to, they're still searching for this anchor, this single, definite, non-contradiction of abstraction, which is going to be the anchor of all meaning. Yeah. And so so all the theories about how to move forward away from, or beyond the success that we have with language models, they're all talking about, using other data, mostly I think talking about using other data. Relevant to, you know, our conversation. So Pedro, Domingos.
Yeah.
His big thing is, I think he is tensor logic. So tensor logic is, as I understand it, he wants to bring logic back into it, because that's the thing that's missing in language models. That's what everybody hates about them, is they're stupid. They can't reason for chips. Right? I mean, there's a few patches being put on which sort of make them do rational things, but most of the, you know, a big problem is that they just make these, I mean, they're terrible at doing anything requiring abstract reasoning, like they're terrible at mathematics.
Do you know how the models do, like how can they tell the difference between good training data and bad training data? Like, because there's a lot of nonsense on the internet as well. How does it tell the difference between like something that will make sense? Because I've done a lot of conversations with like ChatGPT, and for the most part, it has a very, very high make sense rate. How is that there? Because the internet is not as good, I think, as ChatGPT is.
I don't know. I don't know what how they curate their data, or if they do. My inclination would be not to bother. And I mean, if you're going to make your system be emergent from data, then the best thing is to assume that the noise is going to be swamped by the signal. If you don't think that's going to happen, then you're just not going to get anything at all. So I would say that the easiest way to do it would be to simply assume that the signal, which is like something meaningful, whatever meaningful means, because that's not defined.
Yes.
It's defined for language models by prediction. Okay. So you would say that, what's predictive, is going to swamp what's not predictive. And what you think of as nonsense on the internet might actually be quite predictive. So, it might not be as useless as you think it would. I mean, you're thinking of bad information as being what, a wrong statement or?
In a sense, yeah.
But the wrong statements are probably grammatical.
Grammatical, you said?
Yeah, in the sense that, I mean, you know, even nonsense, wrong, you know, somebody saying, you know, the earth is flat or whatever, I don't know what the misinformation is, but they're probably saying it in a grammatical way. If you fed the language model completely random sequences of tokens, then you're not going to get much now.
I'm trying to make it work with you saying that it doesn't have much ability to reason. So I'm trying to understand my experience of it. It's sounding very reasonable to me. Like, how does it pull that off?
Well, things like, these things first started to get a lot of investment, they've received a hell of a lot of hacks to try and cure the hallucinations and the errors that they do produce. And I'm not up to date with all the hacks that people have applied. There's this thing called RAG, which is retrieval augmented generation, where they use different. I think they basically do a sort of a Google search lookup on the query. So instead of relying on the language model alone, they are also doing some kind of regular indexed keyword search. Just like an ordinary Google search has worked for years, and that so that they can anchor it in things that people have said are true. So there's this RAG, retrieval augmented generation, and I don't know. There's probably two or three different systems that people use to. They may also have some kind of logical, they may explicitly push some kind of maths style or logic style co-processor onto it. I believe that if you tried to make these things do maths 2 or 3 years ago, they were terrible.
Mm.
They would come up with confident statements about
yes.
You know, in the form of a mathematical statement, but, you know, saying that 5 and 7 equal 3 or something. And so I think that there's been a lot of effort put into stopping them from doing that. probably by just diverting the specific maths questions to something which does maths well, which is not hard to do. You just pick up a pocket calculator.
Oh, interesting. So it's not the same engine, you think?
I'm sure. I mean, because the language models don't do logic well, right? I mean, that's a big problem. We don't.
Yes, yes.
We don't know what they're, how they're structuring the world. We can't see it.
I think of it as like when you have human students go and memorize a textbook, like memorize the literal words of a textbook without understanding what the thing is actually talking about. And it's like, I could say the words perfectly, but then you present them the real world scenario, but slightly altered. And it's like, this is not what I was trained for. I'm like, yeah, dude, you did not understand then.
Well, that's because you're saying understanding is having an abstract model which you can apply to different situations. And that's what everybody sees as the goal. But it's how reality separates from that, which is the problem. I mean, that's, you know, when people started looking at intelligence 70 years ago, they thought that, you know, that the highest achievement of human thought is logic and reason, and so you just apply that, and then it's all nice. But intelligence does not actually work like that. There's also this thing, Moravec's paradox, which is kind of a summation of that, and it says that the things which you think are going to be easy turn out to be hard, and the things which are harder turn out to be easy. So we can do your pocket calculator or your phone now can do miracles of mathematical logic.
Yes.
But it can't see, you know, but a Tesla, well, I don't want to be sued by Tesla, but say company X's self-driving AI has difficulty seeing
I don't think it's Elon's X company. It is Tesla you're talking about. Well, company X is now the one we're using for speech.
Oh, well, I mean, so X is, so this is ambiguity.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you can't see a fire truck, but you can calculate the nth power, you know, cube root of 22 or something.
From what I know about the self-driving is that they actually moved away from a method that they were using up until now. They moved away from it in I don't think it was even a year ago, where they decided that they removed this is my very layman's terms understanding. They removed all of the code from the neural net. Me using terms I don't understand. And what they did was that they essentially had it try to match what it's seeing with what they have determined to be good driving, and then it would try to just mimic that and then it led to it becoming more smooth, because it's not going through a system of if this then that. It was just mimicking what good drivers do in that situation.
I would think that they were always doing the mimicking, because if then that, I mean, the if then that problem is the only, the problem with that is the bit that you're missing out. It's if situation A, then situation B.
Yeah.
And you can do if then that, but it's the A and the B are that are the problem. you can have if enormous truck stopped in front of you, you know, then apply brakes.
And,
it's blindingly obvious, but, the problem is when a massive truck stopped in front of you. And that's the bit that you have difficulty with.
Yes.
You know, or if the road is clear, then proceed, right? But it's like, but you know, when is the road clear? I think self-driving, they've gone through several iterations and several complete code updates. I don't know if you came across a clip I've posted a few times of Musk talking about his issues with self-driving, probably from a year back now, where he says, look,
the possible asymptote. That one?
Asymptote. Yeah. It seems like you're getting there and you're making good progress, and then it starts to asymptote and it's like. But he says, I think we're out of the local minimum now. And I think it's starting to be like, you know, and so that's this problem. So I think they're always, meeting this. And for me, the asymptote problem is, this contradiction. I think that there's always contradiction in the world. So anytime you try and learn the world without, embracing that contradiction, you're always going to hit a ceiling. You hit the ceiling where things contradict, right? Because it's like, well, it's sort of both. And when it's sort of both, then you can't establish which one it is without having some way of accepting that it can be both. You can't, and this happens actually with humans as well. Getting back, you know, so language is leading the way again. If you get humans and you tell them to label the structure of language, humans also disagree. You say, well, label all the nouns in this text, and they go through and they label all the nouns or the sort of grammatical categories, and they don't agree. Any kind of structure you try and put on it, then you're going to have people, some people say, well, it feels a bit more like this to me. It feels a bit like that to me. And so even for humans, trying to unambiguously, categorize language, they also hit an asymptote. The problem is the labels you're trying to attach. The labels, mm-hmm. There is no set of labels which fits the whole world.
Yes.
And I mean, I think this is coming out all over the place. But it's just, it isn't filtering down to what we're doing in practical terms. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I came across this when I was trying to learn grammar, and so I was pushing it, and I was interested in the idea, and then I talked to people, and they would give me leads. I'd say, well, that sounds a bit like something else. So one of the things that I was told is, oh, that sounds a bit like what was happening with mathematics 100 years ago. So there's this thing in mathematics. I don't know if you've come across that. It's pretty deep in mathematics, which is this incompleteness theorem.
Nope, haven't heard of it. What is it?
So Kurt Gödel, well, what happened, the first thing that happened was that you had Bertrand Russell, okay? So Bertrand Russell, about 1900, he was frustrated by the fact that mathematics has axioms, mm-hmm. right? So mathematics has 4 or 5 axioms, right? 5 is the usual number, I think. And so you sort of list these axioms, and then you can build the rest of mathematics from those axioms. But he didn't like that. He's like, well, why do you have these 5 random things, right? Where did they come from? So he was like, well, sure that we can build mathematics without having to sort of randomly assume 5 axioms. And so he was trying to do that. And, he did this big magnum opus, about, 1900, 1910 with another guy, Alfred Whitehead, I think. But he came to a problem, which was that he was doing it based on looking at mathematics in terms of sets, which was the theory of the time, I think, was it? And he found that he found these contradictions, and the contradiction is I think best summarized by an old paradox, which is the liar paradox. Have you heard of that one?
So in researching you, I learned about it.
Okay.
No, I'll summarize it by saying that I am a liar.
Okay, exactly. Well, you lie. And so this was this contradiction. There was, I think Russell came at it as sort of the set of all sets, contains itself, but if it, you know, or the set of all sets that don't contain themselves or something, and then it's like, well, yeah, but if it's that, then it's the other. And he didn't know, he just said, well, that seems a bit silly, so we'll exclude that. And then he went and built his, his model, but it was just a bit uncomfortable. And then this guy could.
By the way, well, just to clarify it for Nikki listening or anyone listening, the reason why the statement "I am a liar" is a paradox is because if the statement is true, then I'm not a liar. I'm telling the truth. But then if I'm telling the truth, then I'm not a liar. So that makes the statement a lie. So it's like a forever ongoing cycles of truth and untruth unto itself.
Exactly. So it's like a beautiful, I think of it as a beautiful Möbius strip. If you've come,
yes, that's a nice way of imagining it.
In meaning, that meaning itself contradicts itself. And so there was this thing that Russell had, and then he had said, well, it's a bit of a problem, we'll exclude that. And then this guy, Kurt Gödel, about 1930-ish, he came along and he said, well, that's a funny thing. So he said, I'm going to systematize that. And what he did was he proved that actually you were always going to have that sort of contradiction, in any sufficiently powerful, mathematical formalism. Mm. So mathematics will always have things in it which cannot be proven within the mathematics itself. So it basically means there's always going to be random things within mathematics that are true, but they cannot be proven. Mm. So, I mean, and this is a big thing for mathematicians. I mean, you imagine you're a mathematician. You want to prove everything, right? I mean, they're all about proof.
Sure.
Right. You want to say, well, this is true. And why is it true? Well, I'll prove it. And here's the proof. But it's like what he put his finger on was that there's always going to be something in mathematics. And it's like, well, this is true. Yeah, prove it. Well, I can't prove. There's always going to be this randomness within mathematics. And that kind of, that put a bomb under mathematics. I can give you a link. Actually, another one of my favorite, references is a lecture given by a guy named Greg Kuyten talking about the effect that this observation had on him. The way I visualize it is by looking at the axioms. You say, you know, the axioms of mathematics, one of them, I think the fifth axiom of mathematics was that as posed by Euclid 2000 years ago, was that parallel lines do not meet.
Okay.
So, I mean, that sort of sounds, that's a definition of a parallel line, right? Two lines and they don't meet. But mathematicians were never completely happy with that, and they always were always trying to prove it by from the other axiom, so they didn't have to have a separate axiom. But they couldn't prove it. And then one day, I think, in the traditional story, Gauss, mathematician Gauss, a couple of hundred years back, says, well, okay, I can't prove this thing. Let's just assume it's not true. See what happens. And he invented non-Euclidean geometry. And non-Euclidean geometry is the geometry of curved surfaces. And if you think of a curved surface, like the surface of the Earth, and you have parallel lines on that surface, they do meet.
Sure.
Right? If you've got like the parallels of longitude, they meet at the poles.
Yes.
They're parallel as far as you can see when you're sitting on the equator, but then you go up and they meet. So there was this thing that with mathematics, you can have one system of mathematics where parallel lines do not meet, and that's the one that people have been using for thousands of years, and it's very, very useful, and you want to have that axiom that they don't meet.
Yeah.
But you can also have an axiom where they do meet.
Yes.
And it's also really, really useful in certain situations. In any situation where you're dealing with a curved surface, you want to have that. So they're both true. I mean, they meet and they don't meet.
Yes.
So I was finding this, I mean, you know, like I was coming from grammar, I was finding, well, sometimes it's a noun, sometimes it's not a noun, and sometimes it's ruled, but there's an exception to the rule. And, And then I was like, well, okay, so that's kind of like what they found in mathematics. And then, I was finding these contradictions. So these sorts of contradictions, and then you find it coming out in philosophy and postmodern philosophy, which also motivated by language. I was going to say language. It's these things are obvious, are clearer in language. But we still haven't embraced that in our research.
Yes.
So the people who are working on the systems are still convinced that they're going to be able to abstract things in a single consistent way, which will encapsulate all the structure they need. You just need to find the right set of data and it's going to do it for you.
Right. My understanding of this is that, and my approach, and for what it's worth, I do take and sometimes drastically different approach when it comes to psychology, literally oddly enough, because of this very thing. Which I find so interesting, because I, like, at this point you were basically largely talking about, it starts from the human mind and language and then works its way into how we program, how we try to program things.
Sure.
Having an abstraction that can, allow for variables, that I have found to be essential. So if I show up in a situation where there is a person that gives me this set of, facts, these data points, I have like a if this, but then, I have to check what each of these facts are in their specific context to know what my that is. Whereas, I found a lot of, I'll say other people who work in the psychology space, they have a much more, set in stone path of like, if the surface of the situation looks like this, this is always the right, path to take. And it's like, oh, but sometimes it works. I'm like, yeah. And sometimes it doesn't. And it's very detrimental. So you need to have an abstraction that is, that allows for, fluidity, certainly within some parts of it, because like the math example you gave, it's like, we don't know which type of parallel this is.
Yeah.
So is it the one that meets at the end or not? And it makes a lot of difference.
Exactly. Without the context, you don't know what you want.
Yes.
You don't know the truth you want. Truth depends on context. Truth is subjective on context. And sometimes, that's true in one way, but it's not true in another way. You just have to know which way you need.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
And that's what we're not doing. That's what we're still not doing in AI. Not consciously doing. I think that's happening largely by accident in language models. And I think that is the reason that they're large language models, because they're just sort of cataloging an enormous and growing collection of context-dependent situations.
So, and hence why in their data set they have a sometimes it's this, sometimes it's that type of scenario? Is that what you
Well,
mean?
They don't have it in their data set, but I think that's what they're building with when they train them. I mean, so what with these language models, they become enormous. And they require, the enormous power requirements are mostly because of training, and they train them for months and months and months, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
significantly, I imagine.
And so, it's like, why are they getting bigger? Well, we don't know what's inside them, but it looks good, huh? but doesn't it strike you that maybe what they're doing is they're just building up a whole lot of special cases, which you then unpack as a user. And in which case it's like, well, look, yeah, but isn't that just like a stupid thing to do? If you're going to have a system which finds context dependent truth, just wait for the context.
Right.
wait for the context and let the system find the truth you need then, whereas what they're doing now, I'm convinced what they're doing now is they're like, so as the systems are automatically finding truth for every possible context they can. And then your user comes along afterwards and puts in some new context and it comes out and it's like, oh, well, it's just like it made this thing which works. And maybe they have a thing which works because they were able to index this particular context. But it sort of means that we're trying to make these systems, you know, it's like the old monkeys typing the works of Shakespeare. We're trying to make them type the works, type everything beforehand, rather than sort of waiting for the situation to arise and then and typing the situation that you need, or yes, making the analogy you need. So my big thing is I think that AI needs to become smaller and cooler by turning it upside down. Instead of trying to learn everything in one enormous training step, which drains all the power in the world for 6 months, and then sits in an enormous data center, humming in its entirety. But it's never complete because there's always some extra case that, you know, it just didn't get to. Then have a nice, simple, small, cool system which can create all of these different context situations, but doesn't until you need it.
Okay. A hypothetical scenario. Let's say I have, how much would you need for, in terms of funding to, and to be very clear, this is extremely hypothetical.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Elon sends me $1 billion and then he's like, all right, so you're going to go, what would be your first steps, for building this small, cool, efficient, AI system?
Right. Well, I mean, I've been working on it myself.
Okay.
too much of my life.
Okay.
And my first solution was, not good enough. The solution I think that it works the same as language models. It just does it, constantly. Instead of having a giant training phase, it has, it finds things as it needs it. So, but the trouble is that all the technology at the moment uses this backpropagation, right? And backpropagation, it sort of has to do everything at once. It builds a network and then it compares the network with all the things it needs to predict. And, and then it fine tunes a single structure.
Right.
So all the technology at the moment is based on backpropagation. I think that what backpropagation is doing is with language models in particular, with previous systems it didn't. Previous systems of backpropagation fit a network to a supervised training set. So you'd show it a lot of faces and it would fit the network to those faces. With language, for the first time, we're not fitting the training set to any specific fixed solution. We're fitting it to prediction. So what these networks are learning to do is they're learning to find symmetries of prediction. They're finding groups of things which predict the same thing.
Right.
Okay. So it's finding a kind of a symmetry where in language you have, you have the word, nuts are tasty and apples are tasty. And then you say, well, okay, so nuts and apples are both tasty, so we're going to put them in their own, and they have like a predictive symmetry because both nuts and apples predict the sequence are tasty. So they're like a symmetry group in the language, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so it creates a category, and it's a meaningful category. It's actually things that you eat and which are tasty.
Yeah.
It does it by finding a symmetry in the predictions. So, but it finds that symmetry in the predictions using backpropagation it connects the network and then it compares the error between that and slight change and it sort of narrows down. I think we need to find that same symmetry of prediction, but not by backpropagation. I think we, right. So then the question becomes, how do you find symmetries of prediction? Okay. So you have a network which is connected. You've got a lot of sequences of language like, I like apples. I like tea. I like apples. They're for me or whatever. And where they, we've got two things that connect to the same continuation. You have a link. Well, what happens? How do you find those nuts and apples? How do you find those things which are joined by the continuation, eating, whatever? And so I was looking for a way of finding how things which are connected to the same continuation in a network, how you could find that in real time. And then I found this paper that said, well, a way that you can find these like densely connected subnetworks within a network is you can set the network oscillating.
I don't know what that means.
Well, you said that you hit it with a hammer and set it vibrating.
Right.
Right. I mean, so you have a network of sequences, and some of the sequences go down the same path. So you think of lots of words which lead to the same, which all continue down the same path, right? You can sort of think of them as being like little diamonds in a network. Imagine all the words which fit in a different context. So it's like a sentence could be the wheels on the car go round and round, or the wheels on the car, the seats on the car, the paint on the car. Okay, so all these things join. You can think of them all as forming a sort of a little diamond in the network of sequences.
Okay.
And then if you were to make that network vibrate, because all of those words are joined to the same continuation, they're going to tend to synchronize.
Sure.
Right? I mean, because they're connected to the same thing, if you're shaking them, they're all going to shake at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah. So I thought, well, so the way to find these predictive symmetries, which are being found now by backpropagation, maybe the way to find these predictive symmetries would be to set the network vibrating, oscillating.
What would that mean in terms of software or the mind?
Well, it would mean that you would have the your model of the mind would be a network of sequences, which is what we have with language models now.
Yeah.
instead of grouping those elements in those sequences by backpropagation, you would be grouping them by shaking the network and seeing which ones shake at the same or synchronize their shaking.
Yeah. Like, what does the shaking look like in a...
Well, I think it's... I think it's... I mean, look...
Have you seen the movie Zoolander, by the way, with Ben Stiller?
I haven't, no. What
happened? No, it's a ridiculous comedy. He's a male model. There's a whole thing about how not intelligent he is. And there's a scene near the end of the movie where his boss tells him the files are in the computer. And then he goes up to this Mac Mac computer, and he's like, of course, the files are in the computer. And then like an ape, he begins to hit the computer with a stick trying to break in to get them. So when you tell me you need to shake the thing, I just want to let you know what goes through my mind. It's like, all right, I'm going to take a computer and shake it. So if you can give me some context, just so you know how primitive of a mind you're speaking to right now.
Well, I think I would shake it electronically. I think I would, I think I would apply energy, but I would apply it not with a physical hammer, but with a electrical hammer. So I would give charges to the elements in the network. And basically, I think what happens is I think that the spikes synchronize. I think that this is because I mean when I found this idea that a way that you can, I mean, it's a way of finding subnetworks or subnetworks which are richly interconnected within the network.
Yeah,
is you said it oscillating, and you can do it physically as well. I mean, actually, there's a company which is doing something which I think is quite similar, and you may have also come across this because I mentioned it in a few comments recently and earlier. There's a company named Xtropic AI.
Okay.
Xtropic at Xtropic underline AI, and they working on on the basis of previous work with quantum computers, but they are trying to do machine learning using noise, heat noise. In literally in I think they're doing it in silicon. I think they have a prototype which is working. I don't know how it's working. Some sort of super cooled substrate, because you know they need to super cool it because they're looking at vibrations, so they don't want to have a lot of heat noise bearing the signal. They're hitting it with a hammer. I mean, you hit something with a hammer, it heats it up. So they're sort of looking at heat noise. And then they're saying, you know, which things oscillate together when they're hot. Okay. So, I mean, if you like, things which are, when they get hot, maybe they're going to, they glow red, and the stuff which is connected most closely probably glows with the same color because it's you know the heat is transmitting itself, and so heat transmitting itself is saying that vibrations are transmitting themselves or are matching. And so any kind of oscillator, actually, anything which has a signal which goes up and down,
yeah,
can synchronize.
Yes.
And so this company, Xtropic, they're trying to do it with literal heat in atoms vibrating.
Yeah.
I think that you could do it with something like a spiking neural network. Okay, a spike. What's a spike in the brain? A spike in the brain is an electrical charge that builds up into a certain point, and then it sets off it jumps across the synapse.
Mm-hmm.
But you have an electrical signal which is inside a neuron, and it's oscillating, right? I mean, it goes up and down.
True.
And you get masses of these things, obviously masses of these things, these electrical signals combining and then are visible experiment through EEG we know that there are oscillations happening in the brain.
Yes.
Oscillations of electrical signals. So, for me, an obvious way to try to do it would be to have some sort of, model of, electrical charge, and allow the charge on the elements in the network to oscillate, and then see which ones synchronize their oscillations. And that, so I mean, what I'm trying to do is find a way of collecting things according to the way that their predictive symmetries. How are they symmetric, or how are they joined in the way they predict?
Yes.
And so, I mean, the way I came to was that maybe the way that cognition is finding these predictive symmetries is by synchronizing the charges on neurons. So what I would like to do, you were saying, if Elon were to bung me a cool,
if you could run an experiment that's just funded,
something which is like less than the cost of building another 200 nuclear power stations.
Yes.
In the short term. It might be fun look, people have built spiky neural networks, right? Intel has had one for about, 10 years. IBM built one in the noughts, called True North. But they didn't know what to do with it. And I think it hasn't gone anywhere. Intel built one, they call it, Loihi. They're trying to figure out, what they're all doing is they're all trying to figure out how to use, because they like spiky neural networks because they're better in a lot of ways. They're a lot cooler. Surprise. Because only the elements which spike are using power, right? So it's much cooler than the networks, which language models currently run on, because they're all based on weights and it means that all of the links are always powered up all the time. It's very hot. So, I mean, people like spiking networks and they're trying to figure out how to use spiking networks, but they can't figure out a way to use them. They can't think how to use them because they've got the things which work, which use weights, and then they've got these spiking things. But, you know. I would like to, try and find the same symmetries that are now found by backpropagation, but find them in real time using oscillations in the network to find symmetries.
Super interesting. I had never heard this before as an idea, and I certainly don't have enough of an understanding to be able to simulate in my head what this would look like. So
there are people working on oscillations in the brain. I've come across chunks of software that people are trying to replicate what they observe in different parts of the brain. And they've built software which oscillates in different ways, but they don't have any idea. I mean, they don't have a model for what they might want. When we're looking at the brain, we're also sort of looking from the outside in, and people see oscillations. There's actually this thing which goes back 30 years or more called binding by synchrony.
Okay.
And binding by synchrony is an experimental observation that that perceptual categories seem to correspond to synchronized spikes, oscillations in the brain. So they did experiments, and people, when they were looking at things, they would perceive an object, and when they perceived it, then their brains would be synchronizing, the oscillations would synchronize. And this is a theory for how objects are perceived in the brain, which was called binding, and so binding something together as an object by synchrony. It was observed experimentally. But I think, I mean, this was also like coming from the outside, and they didn't have any idea how and why those oscillations might be synchronizing. I'm coming at it from the other direction. I'm coming at it from the direction of saying, hey, you need a network which is connected sequences of observations, and the sequences will synchronize. 30 years ago, they didn't sync, you know, they're not looking at sequences. They're just saying, oh, it synchronizes somehow. I wonder how it synchronizes. Don't know how it synchronizes. I've actually spoken to the guy, I think, who coined the term, binding by synchrony, a guy, Christoph von der Malsberg. And he said he gave up on the idea because he couldn't make a model which synchronized, in a way that corresponded to perceptual objects, and he couldn't make it work fast enough, or he didn't have any way of making things synchronize according to its membership of some kind of meaningful category. Well, I mean, I've got a way it could happen, right? It could happen because things which make the same prediction might be a meaningful category, and those are the meaningful categories we're now stumbling into with the language models.
I want to see if I understood you correctly, or if I'm hallucinating this understanding. When the research you cited about the synchronization when you see an object, is it that like my brain sees an object and then the neurons related to that object, all of them just sort of oscillate in the same direction together?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think, because for a start, you don't know what neurons are associated with the object, or at least you don't know except by presenting an object and seeing what happens in the brain. And I suppose what I'm imagining what happened, or as I recall, is that, they present an object and then they observe that somewhere in the brain that you get some kind of synchrony. And so they thought, oh, okay, so this seems to be significant in terms of a response to an object. But they didn't know where it was coming from.
And in current LLMs, is it like literally the entire, database, or it somehow gets cross-checked as opposed to literally just the things that are related, getting activated or something? Is that?
With current LLMs, they're finding the same thing. They're finding groups of things which are which have the same prediction. So they're finding predictive symmetries in a network of sequences. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that the back propagation is not real time. It happens once, very slowly, over like a 10-month training phase. And so like the whole network gradually narrows in on the best global solution for everything.
Right.
So you don't have any kind of discrimination of this context or that context. It's like it's optimizing the whole enormous data center of processes and all the data, of it at the same time. And because it has to do all of it at once, it can't capture contradiction, right? Because that goes against the whole idea of optimizing everything at once. So they just fundamentally cannot get contradiction.
Now, how does this relate to what I've read from you about intelligence as compression versus intelligence as expansion?
Ah, well, this is the thing. So if you're doing things in real time, and you can, if you do things in real time, you can have contradictions, right? Because it's like, well, in this situation, you get this kind of symmetry.
Yes.
And in another situation, you get another symmetry. So you have the same set of data.
Yes.
But it has two symmetries.
Yes.
And then it's like, well, each of those symmetries maybe have a different, like, maybe there's two interpretations of them. And then maybe it's two interpretations of those. And you can have this sort of, it grows. It's at the moment, people assume that you're compressing. You've got all this data. We don't want all this data. It's too much for us. We want to push it down and make it smaller. And then, you know, paradoxically, they get enormously big. It's like they're small models. Are enormous, right? But they think, it's smaller. It's kind of smaller. It's enormous, but yeah, okay. So they think they're getting smaller. But if you embrace contradiction, then it's natural that things will get bigger. But it's just they're not going to get bigger all at once. They're going to get bigger over time, right? So as time goes by, yeah, and you arrange things one way, it's like, oh, that's useful. And it's like, oh, you can arrange them another way too. It's also useful. Oh, look, you can arrange it. So it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So, so you've still got things which are useful because they're predictive, right? Things which predict are useful, but they're not smaller than the data. They're actually bigger than the data. So it's like, it means that you have to change your thinking. I mean, people have assumed that, that models of meaning would be useful because they would be smaller than the mess of detail in the world, right? They assumed that when we understood meaning, it would be a small set of principles and that would explain the whole world. So that the utility would be, that you'd be collecting things, but you wouldn't have to collect the whole world because you'd just have all these principles that would explain it all.
Sure.
So the usefulness would be that it would be smaller. But when you give up on the idea that things are fixed abstractions and you focus on the task of prediction, and prediction is decoupled from what the actual grouping is. You have two different groupings. If they both predict, they're both good. So it's decoupled. So your groupings you can have an infinite number of groupings. And then you come up with a new grouping. It's like, wow, hey, I've had a new idea. It's actually a model of creativity. You think, what's creativity? Creativity is a new grouping of the world, which predicts it in a way that nobody thought of before.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I mean, we have these language models and they say, well, they're not very creative. And yeah, of course they're not creative because you're assuming that you're going to compress everything and make it smaller. But if you accept contradiction, then the meaning can grow. There's no reason why you shouldn't have an infinite amount of meaning. If they're all different and they're all useful, why not? They're just, so that, it's an expansion of the world rather than a compression. It's just sort of fundamentally turns upside down the way we're thinking about AI at the moment. We're thinking about AI as compressing everything into a smaller amount of core abstractions. But I don't think that it's what it is. I think that what intelligence is, it's finding things which are useful, but it's finding new things. So expansion instead of compression. It also, I mean, it works in all sorts of other ways too. I mean, it's very suggestive of all kinds of little puzzles. Because if something gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it's kind of relevant for, I mean, I don't know if you've thought much about mathematical chaos. Mathematical chaos is when any small difference in a system grows. So this is the famous butterfly effect, right?
Mm.
So the butterfly effect says you've got a butterfly flapping its wings in Africa. And so it flaps its wings, that causes a little flurry, and then the flurry grows and grows and grows, and eventually becomes a hurricane off the, you know, the East Coast or wherever.
Sure.
So that's chaos. So if you have a system where differences get bigger, that's actually a model for that. It means you cannot. It means it's a system which cannot be abstracted more than the system itself, because any difference will propagate and grow bigger, and any difference will result in a completely different outcome. Right? So this means that you cannot copy such a system. And the weather is one such system, okay? The weather on Earth is such a chaotic system. And that's why you cannot predict what the weather's going to be in your hometown in 6 months, because it's chaotic, right? I mean, otherwise you'd be able to say, oh, we've got the equations and it's going to be light drizzle with north northeasterly wind, right? In 12 months time. You can't do that because the differences grow. But if you have a system like that, it's actually a model of free will. Because if you're God and you create such a system, you can create it, but you don't know what it's going to do.
Right.
Right? Because only the system, the only thing which can tell what that system is going to do is that system. The only way that you know if it's going to be raining or dry in your hometown in 9 months is to sit there and look at it and wait and see what it does.
Yes.
So you can say that the weather has free will, right? I mean, it's like even you creating the weather, you don't know exactly where the rain is going to be is going to occur.
For sure.
Yeah. So like this idea of a system which expands instead of like a system which you think of as being compressed, it's also kind of suggestive of solutions for our intuition of free will, because it means that you can't predict what, even if you create the person, you cannot predict what that person is going to do. It's also suggestive of something like consciousness, because consciousness is, to me, anyway, it's kind of very suggestive, because consciousness is awareness of something for itself. So it's sort of like something being bigger than itself.
Yes.
At least for me, the idea that something can become bigger than itself is suggestive of what might be the source of our intuition of consciousness. So I think this idea of things that get bigger rather than being that gets getting smaller. It's a very practical solution for a problem that we have when we learn grammar. First thing.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's super true. Yeah, actually.
Beyond that, it's kind of suggestive of solutions that might be for other things which are still mysteries for us. Yeah. You can find other people who are saying sort of similar things. So there's a guy, a very famous book. I don't know if you've read it. Douglas Hofstadter. Have you? Gödel Escherbach.
No, I'm not familiar.
So this is a very famous book in geek circles, and well worth a read. But he sort of goes back to that maths I was talking about, and he follows different little flurries of intuition on pretty much the same lines. And it was an enormous, it was wonderful for me, because I was saying all these things about, oh, contradiction, and, you know, maybe this thing can't be described more completely than itself, blah, blah, blah. And this guy said, oh, you should read Hofstadter. And I read it, and he's saying, oh, yeah, he's saying the same thing. But like the folks that observed binding by synchrony, Hofstadter had no actual network which created this expansion. He just had this idea, probably going to need some kind of expansion. So it's a similar sort of thing, but they didn't have the nuts and bolts idea of what kind of network it might be that would do this.
So in my own experience of having a neural net, that's a fun way of talking about my own self. What I've seen in its development, as I've been fostering this non-artificial intelligence,
and yourself, and your conscious self-awareness.
Yes, exactly.
you being bigger than yourself and looking in at yourself. Yeah.
It literally. Yeah. I actually have an image of that. I don't know what this. I think it's essentially it's like a cube within a cube. That as a symbol for essentially consciousness and like the self that I normally think of, I'm like, hey, I'm Serena. That's actually the little cube that exists within this larger cube that I can become aware of, and it helps recontextualize things actually. So anyways, in my development of myself, I've noticed that there's both things happening. There is expansion happening. That's literally learning. And it's a very, I don't remember where you said it, but there was something about, learning in real time. And I was like, oh yeah, that's absolutely necessary. Yeah. And then there is also, I don't know if compression is the right term, but there is maybe distilling. And, I feel like there is a difference between compression and distilling.
Well, I mean, I think we are when we're learning, we are compressing. It's just, I think that that there are contradictions. So when you have contradictions, it means there's two ways of compressing. And they're both, I mean, they do compress, and you need to compress things because our brains are puny, right?
Sure. And
so you need to compress things down to some lame ass, you know, principle in order to do anything, right? Otherwise, it's like you have to say, oh, well, I don't know.
Why lame ass? Doesn't need to be. I have some badass principles. It's just
sort of the humility of the human condition, that, you know, forced on us by the size of the universe.
Sure.
Another thread you might like to go off on actually was a lecture I can send. It was between Jordan Peterson. He was talking with a guy. What's his name? McAllister. They were talking about right brain, left brain.
Okay.
And left brain being logical and ordered, and right brain being very sort of intuitive and open to novelty. And they're talking about how the sort of left brain thinking it enforces its own rigid patterns on the world, and it resists change, and how this is kind of symptomatic of problems we have in society. But I mean, we need that. We need that logical brain. Otherwise we can't do anything. We can't build a jet aeroplane if we're going to sit there and say, oh yeah, but this fan blade might be slightly different to that fan blade. I mean, you need to simplify things to get things done.
Of course.
So they are compressions, but it's just, the new idea is that on some level there's going to be contradiction, and we need to embrace the contradiction if we're going to have creativity.
Yes. I would also I think add to that you need to embrace the contradictions to be able to distill the whatever deeper truth that might be that gives rise to the possibility of the contradictions.
Yeah.
If you try to remove the possibility of contradiction, then you also disallow yourself from seeing if there is a deeper truth that gives rise to the multiple options.
Yeah, you can't see novelty. Yeah, you can't. You won't come to any new solutions unless you. So you were saying that in your experience of your own neural network, you see both, right? You see compression and you see
absolutely
novelty. So, I mean, you might be interested to listen to this talk between Peterson and the other guy,
McAllister.
Mac something. Because he's written a book, basically left brain, right brain, which I sort of resist actually, this whole left brain, right brain thing.
Sure. Yeah.
I've heard that from a long way back. It was a bit of a simplification itself, but he's quite heavy on it, and he seems to be fairly erudite.
He's very left brained about it.
Yeah, no,
very rigid.
Yeah, maybe. in an open sort of way. But he was talking about both aspects. So if you know you're seeing both aspects, I mean he was saying, yeah, there's both aspects, and both are necessary. It's a bit like one of Peterson's themes, which is that you need to have logos and you need to have the chaos. So you know you need to have both. I'll see if I can find the guy's name. I should be able to find, rather than just saying Mick something. But I don't know. Let me see. Best just to send it to you later, probably. Not him. McGilchrist. Ian McGilchrist. Wisdom, delusion, consciousness, and the divine. You might like that because I think you're a bit spiritual. So, Dr. Ian McGilchrist.
Perfect. Thanks. I will check that out.
Anyway, so yeah, I mean, I think you're right. There's both is there, but the bit that we're missing at the moment in their technology specifically is the expansion bit. And I think that language models have led us to it blindly, yeah, stumbling without thinking, just like saying, oh, GPUs, you know, that I was using in my gaming rig. I'll use them for neural networks. And then it's like, oh, you know, if I do it for language, suddenly I've got this creepy thing that seems to be talking to me. So I think that blindly we're stumbling to away from structure to this kind of openness. And then we see it with the size, right? I mean, these can get enormous. Well, why are they expanding? Well, I don't know. It seems to be a flaw in our compression. We're stumbling to it, but we're not thinking about it. We're not saying, hey, you know, maybe this problem, this lack of structure in which we see as a problem, maybe that's a solution.
Super interesting. From my own, like right now I'm almost exclusively focused on human development, and I have just over time come to see it as like developing neural nets within humans. Mm-hmm. I've noticed humans don't always appreciate being regarded as neural nets within biological bodies.
Humans sometimes seem to not appreciate almost anything.
That is true.
Lack of appreciation seems to be deep in the biology.
Yeah. I'm listening to everything you're saying, reading everything you've written through also in that lens as well, and trying to see where I see parallels between how learning happens and how
Yeah, well, I mean, I think learning, or rather, it's the interesting thing is how creativity happens.
Yes.
How we change, you know, how we jump out of what McGilchrist would probably say, jump out of left brain into right brain. Mm. There was a guy I came across years ago, Snyder, I think his name was, working at University of Sydney or something in Australia. And he had this idea that autism, I don't know if he had this idea, but anyway, he was trying to jump people out of their fixed conceptions by actually putting a helmet on them and scrambling their brains with magnetic fields.
Okay.
And
what was he trying to do?
Well, he literally was scrambling people's brains to try and make them more creative.
And did it work?
Well, I think so. You can look it up. Snyder, I think. Snyder.
Okay.
I can find the link if you can't find it, but he was, creativity, University of
Alan, Sydney, Alan Snyder.
Alan Snyder. Yeah, that sounds like him.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it went anywhere after that. I haven't heard of it recently, but I mean, it fit with me. So for instance, I think I'd working on my idea for what that thought is an organization of information and the problem being that they, or the solution in way being that they can contradict. I was looking at autism as a failure to. So like autistics, some of them anyway, have fantastic memories for detail.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I mean, my thesis was that, when we learn something, we don't only learn the abstraction. We actually keep the detail, you know, because I'm saying that you need to be able to abstract at runtime. So you need to be able to order things in different ways.
Sure.
As you go. So you can't throw away the information. You must remember the details so that you can find the new order coming out of it when you need it.
Yes.
And it, so I was fascinated to find that autistics seem to be evidence that humans do retain detail of perception. It's just they can't usually access it.
Interesting. Right?
So when we access things, we seem to only access things in terms of these sort of broad abstractions. But the fact that you have people who are, you know, autistic, and the autistics, they, some of them anyway, can retain fantastic detail. You know, there's a thing, there's a guy that goes on a helicopter ride over Rome. I don't know if you've seen that.
I've heard of it actually.
Yeah, and he, you know, so he flies over Rome for an hour, and then they take him back to the lab, and then he spends a week sketching all of Rome, you know, right down to the number of windows on the building on the corner of the Vatican, and all this sort of
thing. Wow.
He just retains everything. But so it seems that autistics, they are like a window into what the brain is actually retaining, but they seem to have lost the facility to order it. So they're not, and that's I suppose why some autistics are like can't handle too much stimulation, because they're receiving the stimulation direct, right? They're getting it's like a fire hose, whereas you and me in our maturity, We're closed off to most novelty, right? We're like, oh, it's like, you know, those children asking their stupid questions. I know everything already.
When it comes to maturity, I would say, please speak for yourself, Rob.
Well, I'm saying maturity in terms of lack of, you know, inability to see novelty.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So as you get older, you develop more certainties about the world, you're less able to see things in a new way.
Generally speaking, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, relative to my kids, they definitely see a lot more things in ways that I had not thought of. So I learned through them to see things in the ways that they do that I hadn't.
And I think you get less pleasure from novelty as you get older as well. It actually feels physically harder work. It's kind of interesting for me actually, because, you know, I like learning languages and I'm finding that as time goes by, I've always got a lot of pleasure from the making the different patterns from a new language in my mind. It's wild, but, it's hard work, right? It's like, I'm finding, oof, you know, it's like doing arithmetic in my head.
Right. A lot of the learnings I've had has been through essentially meditating with psychedelics and then facilitating those for people. And it's a very interesting field when it comes to looking at it through the lens of neural nets.
Yeah.
I was going to say, one of the really, really big things for people is their experience of novelty, actually. There is in that different state of experiencing things, there is just so much novelty in the same moment that they previously, it's like there was much more of a, this is my understanding of we have much more of it like a top down understanding of the room we're in. So we're like, oh, I know this room, like, you know, like the back of my hand, and I know the back of my hand.
Yeah. And you ignore it, right? You ignore it.
Because you know it already.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on the bloody room. I'm doing something else.
Yeah. It's like, I could even tell you a list of all the things in it. So in that state, not only do you realize that you actually have, like, it feels as if you've never seen this room before. So everything is novel, but it's like, the back of your own hand, haven't also looked at, before either. It's like fresh data.
Yeah.
So that's,
it's probably what we're talking about, that, it's sort of scrambling the old order. And finding new patterns in it, combining things in new ways. And that's what language models can't do, because with back propagation, they have to do everything at training time.
Yes.
They can't find the new patterns.
Yes.
And they don't imagine that they want to find the new patterns, because they can't imagine that patterns contradict. if right. patterns don't contradict, you don't want to do it. You don't want to do it once and then you forget it, like your room, right? I just want to learn the room once. I don't want to be like looking at the room every day and going, whoa.
Yeah. To be clear, I don't want to be on psychedelics every day.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of, I guess that would be the extreme of what I'm suggesting is it's like, you know, every day you wake up and you'd never get out your room because you'd just be like going, oh man, and look at that too, sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it does help to distill things down into, some degree of like functionality as like, so you can explore further.
Mm. But unless we grasp that at the moment we're completely ignoring the extent to which things can, or even the idea that they can contradict. So we're completely missing out on the creative aspect.
Yes.
And it should be simple. I mean, it may be really, really simple to incorporate that. We just have to dump the backdrop and use the same learning mechanism, this predictive symmetry and sequences, and it needn't be only for language. It could be the brain may work with predictive symmetries and sequences way beyond language and everything else it does. Like, I mean, for instance, why does the eye perceive the world by, performing saccades all over the place? Saccades? So when you look at something, the eye is not stationary. It's only sharp in the very center, and what it does is it flicks back and forth, right, with saccades.
Oh, I was unfamiliar with this.
Yeah, I mean, the eye is constantly moving. If it stops moving, you stop seeing. So it's like, I don't know how deep this whole sequences thing goes, but it makes sense to me that when the nervous system was first evolving in the first worms, probably sequences were, something even which was significant for, like, you know, the proto worm. So probably the proto nervous system, it may have evolved from a very early time to, find symmetries in sequences of experiences so that it could better predict the future. Even if those sequences were just like, you know, I taste sugar. And it gets warmer, so I will combine those things. You know, that's a symmetry. So that's a prediction symmetry or something. When it gets warmer, then I get more sugar or something like that.
Yeah.
So this whole sort of prediction of things as grouping predictive symmetries, may be very deep in cognition, going way, you know, back to, earliest nervous systems.
Yeah.
So. It should be very easy. If we once, accept that, we need to do it, we can't do everything all at once in an enormous training phase.
Hmm. Yes. I mean, it's, that's how I've been approaching my own development and then, the development of like, people around me. It's just what is it that is in front of you right now? And, what needs to be developed here, and then let's make sure we develop it really, really well to, I don't know if this at all relates, but that's how I'm hearing what you're saying about non-human neural nets.
It's all about perception of the world and what meaning means, or, you know, what is meaning at root. So it's going to be relevant to anything that humans do, self-development or recognizing a fire truck.
Yes. Yeah. The something that I would love to just put it on your radar. I don't know what to make of it or what you could make of it. But something I've noticed from my own experiences with psychedelics, specifically meditating on high doses. Because it's a different state than low doses or approaching it in a non-meditative way. Seems to be humans quite universally. So it's not like a me thing or any person specific thing. It's like just a operating system of us. there is a level of our or a depth of our consciousness that is pre-language.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm sure. No, I mean, I don't think language is fundamental at all. I just think that it's kind of like a cheat code.
It's definitely a gateway. And when I speak with people, obviously I'm not there in some telepathic. I do think there's a lot that happens non-verbally, of course, as well.
A lot of criticism of LLMs and that sort of thing is attacking the idea that language is absolutely fundamental. I don't think language is basic to cognition at all. I think that it's just another example of the same kind.
Yeah.
It's just that it's a particularly transparent example of the same kind.
Yes. So then we are aligned there. I'm curious then about what you were saying with the oscillations of the, would it be accurate to say nodes of information? Is that you're oscillating the nodes?
I think if you took it down to the metal, so to speak, like down to the lowest level, it would be sequences of perceptual spikes from whatever sense organs you have.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to do it with language, it's going to be like vibrating cilia in your inner ear, right? And that produces a sequence of spikes.
Yeah.
But they're all going to be sequences.
Yeah.
They're all going to be perceptual sequences. And then you need to cluster those sequences and you need to group them into things, right? So that you can't just have like, you know, spike trains. I think if you wanted to go right down to the baseline, you would be stuck with sequences coming of spikes coming from whatever sense organ you're looking at, whether it be vision or hearing, or the worm tasting sugar and heat. Yeah, I think it would just be you'd start with a sequence of spikes, and then you would find how those sequences of spikes cluster in some way, and you can build structure on top of that. At the very lowest level, there may also be a clustering in terms of different associations and reward mechanisms. Like for language, at least for syntax, it's very clearly, so syntax being how groups of words combine, as opposed to like morphology being what makes up a word.
Yeah.
And syntax is the interesting one, because syntax is the one which is new. Every sentence you say is a little bit new, right? So syntax is not where you find novelty. So I think that this grouping on symmetries of prediction is vital for creating new novelties or syntax. There may be a layer below that, which is just in terms of things which are repeated. And repetition, I mean, repetition is something which people use at the moment as a way of, that's like a basic mechanism of what they call unsupervised learning. So for neural networks, lots of people have tried to build AI models for language by grouping things which repeat. It's an obvious thing to do. You group sounds which repeat, or groups of letters. You group letters which repeat, you get words, right? I mean,
sure.
So repeated structure is a mechanism which probably exists as well. So things which repeat get grouped.
Yes.
But I think that the bit that we're missing is a creative one, which is things which are grouped because they make the same predictions.
Yes.
So, going down to a lower level, these sequences of perceptual spikes, there may be some sort of grouping in terms of repeated patterns as well. But the one which I think we're missing is the grouping of things which make the same predictions, even if they're different.
Can you give a specific example of this, just so I could ground it in my mind?
So I think language is just a very simple window into it. And repeated sequences are words, right? Words, you can easily find the words in a language just by looking at letters that repeat, right? So if you,
sure.
you group, if you, you get a, you take out all the spaces in an English text and you, and then you just list things in terms of how often the sequences repeat, you're going to get a list of words.
Yeah.
But you're not going to get grammar that way. You, what you get is you get things which sometimes, which repeat kind of, but they're sort of a little bit different. And you don't, when you try and make, rules, you find yourself, hypothesizing categories like noun and verb and noun phrase and that sort of thing. But you can't get a precise, definition. So, okay. So, you were asking for an example. I think language is easy. The mechanism, which I think is being missed at the moment, but, or it does exist in large language models, LLMs, but is mistaken because they attempt to do it one time only instead of doing it, instead of embracing contradiction. But this mechanism is to group things according to shared prediction. So if you have, you can do it as like a gap filling test, right? So take any sentence. Okay. I've got a letter here, and on it is written, in event of non-delivery, please return to. Okay. So you could delete the word, event and, replace it with, imagine other words that could have come in that sentence. In the case of non-delivery, in the, I don't know, what other words could you fit in there? In the,
happenstance.
Happenstance. So you could make a grouping of words which all have roughly the same meaning because they all fit in the same context.
Right.
And that's the mechanism. That's what I think is that's the mechanism of grouping things according to shared prediction or shared context. Interesting. And that's what LLMs do. You'll see it. They talk about it as embedding because the word's embedded in the context, roughly. So LLMs do that, but they try and do it all at training time. I think that those groups of things which can be substituted have to be real time because there are you can't find a single group of words which fits in every context. So those words were what in the case in the happenstance. Okay, so you've got a grouping there. You've got event. Case and happenstance. And then you might have another sentence like, we're having a big event on Tuesday. Okay. And, you can't use the same grouping because you say, oh, we're having a big case on Wednesday. Well, it doesn't really work. We're having a big happenstance on Wednesday. Yeah. Doesn't really.
No.
Right. So it's like, what's a good grouping in one context is not quite a good grouping in another context.
Yes.
So you need to keep the original text so that you can find all of these groupings at runtime, at the time that you want to make the generalization.
Yeah. So is this what current LLMs do?
Yeah, but they only do it once. Because they're dependent on backprop. Their whole paradigm is dependent on learning abstractions one time only by backpropagation. That's the only tool they have.
So how could you? I know I asked a similar question before as well, and you said the thing about oscillations. But how could you do it without the one time training?
What I said before.
Yeah, exactly. So predictively, I understand, but I'm
stuck in my own lingus. I don't know. If you can think of a different way, that's good too. How could you find those groupings over an entire body of language? At the time that you're speaking or that you're hearing, you know, at runtime. I mean, you know, so you're thinking of a language. What is a language? A language, let's say a language is a bunch of sentences that you've heard in your lifetime, right? Going back to your childhood.
Sure.
And that's all stuck in your head. Like an autistic would maybe have all of those. It would, maybe the autistic would just have those raw, you know, they might be able to repeat them. They might not be able to say anything meaningful, but they might be able to repeat the exact sentences. So they're all stuck in your brain there. So now you're, because you're an intelligent entity, you're going to group those sentences in some meaningful way for one, some way which has meaning for the situation you're now in, right?
Yeah.
A pretty girl's walked into the room and you want to chat her up. So you're going to think of a new grouping for gone into the bread shop and you want to buy a loaf. So you want to put things together in a way which is going to achieve your goals. So how do you group those sentences and elements of those sentences together in a way which is going to get you your loaf of bread? And do it at runtime. So, you know, what LLMs do now is they learn groupings. And because buying bread is a fairly common situation, if you ask it to buy bread, it will probably do it quite happily. But if you want it to do it, if you want it to think of a new way of conceiving bread, then you want it to be able to do that, at runtime, do it differently at each moment. So yeah, if you can think of a way to group words which can be substituted in a context or which share a context and do that in real time, I think that's what we need. For me, the one which is striking me most forcibly is to have a network of those sequences. And because words which share context will be richly connected with, they will share rich connections with those contexts.
Yeah.
They should, if you put energy in that system, if you charge it and you it's like producing spikes and oscillating.
Yeah.
The rich interconnectivity should cause those oscillations to synchronize. And that will be a way of identifying it.
Right. And this would be on a literal hardware level.
Well, you could do it in software as well. You just have, you just simulate it with software. But yeah, I mean, if you look at what Xtropic are doing, they don't have, right. So Xtropic, I love what they're doing, but they don't have the idea of contradiction. They just have this idea that, that oscillations might be a way to, find, things which are tightly interconnected. So they're actually doing it, but, you know, with oscillations, literally oscillations, which are just, heat noise.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, would it be hardware? Any system where you've got interconnectivity, where things are connected. And so, stimulation on one element is going to transmit itself to closely connected elements.
Yeah.
And that could be a software activation, or it could be a physical activation. For the brain, I think it's electrical. Mostly. I mean, obviously there's chemicals coming in there too, but I think when we group words in order to buy a loaf of bread, I think we're synchronizing all the words which are similar to bread.
yeah, I understand.
Yeah. Or maybe we're synchronizing it with butter so we can buy butter too.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the idea. But it's in order to think that it's interesting, you have to accept that meaningful groupings contradict, and that's something which is completely ignored by current state of the art for all of their $7 trillion requested investment by Sam Altman. I'm sure he's never. I would place bets that he's never conceived of the idea that that the patterns his systems are learning might contradict, and that could be the reason why his language models get so large.
Hmm. Very, very interesting. Cool. Rob, thank you for your time and taking the time to actually explore these with me.
Thank you for your curiosity. You wouldn't believe how rare that is. Well, perhaps you would.
I would believe it. I have been curious about that as well. So yeah, it's nice. And also on your side, taking the time to actually explain your stance is not that common either, actually. So there's a...
I think people will talk until the cows come home about their hobby horse. It's just, I think it's
you would think so. There's a, at least this is my perception of it. So I maybe you can confirm for me, what led to it. Cause I just asked if you're open for an X space. You said yes, right? Yeah. I have asked many people, who, for the most part, never responded. Like they would be very much in the chat on text. And then the second, the idea of a more, rich, higher bandwidth, exchange would be possible. They'd be like, either disappear or no, mostly disappear, actually.
I have a suspicion that the possible reason for that would be, that they simply don't understand what they're talking about.
Right.
I think possibly people, it would be interesting to look at specific cases, but, I don't know why people argue things, but, I think a lot of the time people just don't understand things, and, they may be repeating, I'm thinking of Kamala Harris. I'm sorry to get political.
I am very much so. So I think of, I literally frame, those types of situations as people being LLMs.
I think a lot of the time people are just repeating dogma.
Yeah.
And if you ask them to explain their reasoning and to elaborate and to expand, possibly they're just uncomfortable because they don't know.
Yeah.
It's like a child asking, you know, so the curious child is like, you know, well, why is the sky blue? And it's like, don't ask stupid questions. It's blue.
I have really great interactions with my kids actually, because that, that's very much welcomed, for me. And, it's like the best case scenario for me is that they ask me a question. I'm like, wow, I actually don't know that one.
Yeah.
Let's find out. And then, great.
You're in the sort of the logos, rigid, I know how the world works. I don't need to think about that again. And then they're like saying, oh, you haven't thought of this one, buddy.
It's lovely. And there was a time I had this, recently I had a conflict with my son, stepson. So there is something interesting there where there, the neural net has been programmed in other ways. So now I'm encountering someone else's programming to an extent. This was like a really fundamental thing where I was asking him in a moment of conflict of like, hey, why do you trust yourself? Which is a really foundational, idea. And then his response was because it's me. And I was like, that is a terrible reason. Because like I have learned with my own self that I should only trust the things that I, that there's been evidence for. So beyond that, I'm open to learning. So I wouldn't assume that I am necessarily good. I wouldn't necessarily assume like literally anything other than what I have seen to be, true. And, because if you assume that, like, for example, because it's you, you have to be good, then there's going to be a lot of evidence that you're not going to want to look at that might contradict that actually.
People don't like to look at contradictory evidence. You know, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And yeah,
reason I find pleasure in that sort of process.
Yeah. Well, you know, so we're all wired slightly differently like that. And the ones that are curious, they're the ones that are open to the novelty and get pleasure from the novelty and at different ages. So yeah, probably the reluctance you find in people to explain their thinking more deeply is because it's not actually going any deeper.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
If you look at the people who have put a lot of thought into it, I would think that they probably would be love to bore you stiff with the details.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you also for mentioning the few different resources: Extropic, the Jordan Peterson guest, and the Snyder Brain Scrambling. I will look into those. And if you have anything else you think would be interesting, please share.
Well, if you have any questions, then just fire me a message, or we can chat again, whatever. I mean, I have a lot actually, because
imagine
different personalities work on different things, and I work on understanding things, I've gone down a lot of threads on this, and have a lot of interesting references and suggestions. Anyway, so you got a bit to work with there, but feel free. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think, or you think that you, or if you can pull it apart, come and pull it apart, you know, put me under my
nose. Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. I mean, what I brought up with the whole, there's a depth of consciousness that's, pre-language or sub-language, and you had no issue with that. I was like, okay, cool. Then you're actually super on point. Our foundations align actually. So,
you know, if somebody can find a thread which will unravel my sweater, save me trouble in the long run. So I'm very happy to have any criticisms or any angles like that.
Yeah,
okay, cool.
I'm still going to have I'm going to loop on, the whole idea of oscillating, networks. I have like a picture of it in my head, so I'm just going to loop on that for some time, try to see if I can understand it or connect it to my
which part for me, and it hit me like a brick, because I was looking for a way to group meaningful elements in language sequences, and then it's like maybe oscillations could be that, and it's like, what the, you're telling me that it's like, we know that the brain has oscillations in it. I've always just assumed, I mean, I've always sort of like, oh, yeah, oscillations, but that's just superficial. That's just like, yeah, that's like, implementation detail. It's not
structurally relevant. System.
Yeah. In fact, look, I came across, the other day on Twitter, I came across this group of, neuroscientists, and they had a group discussion about whether oscillations are an epiphenomenon or if they are meaningful.
Okay.
So neuroscientists are still debating. They're still debating whether, you know, everybody knows that oscillations are happening in the brain, right? But nobody knows why. So it's like this group of like 6-7 neuroscientists were all sitting there for an hour or 2 hours. Arguing or discussing about whether, you know, why the, you know, whether the oscillations matter, people just still have no idea. But for me, it's like, oh, this thing which I just like stumbled on as maybe a solution for my narrow technical problem is actually observed in the brain. It's like,
yeah,
you know, it's like the thing which I'd always thought was insignificant might actually be my solution. So for me, it hits me like a brick. It's like, of course, that's how it's happening.
Do you know a guy named, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, but why is it, why do you find it, not, intuitively obvious?
Why do I know it's my intuitively obvious?
Why do you find it difficult to, and perhaps you, why do you, or do you not see that it would cause, that if you have a network and subnetworks are tightly connected, that those subnetworks will probably synchronize more closely than the wider network?
No, for sure. For sure. Yeah. It's, I don't have any, reasons, like I'm not trying to make it make sense. I'm more so, I want to let it sit with my existing network of understanding and then see how it connects and then how I can re-understand everything I currently understand.
you know, this is my model of understanding, and I use it all the time. My model of understanding is you have to organize experience.
Yes.
If you don't have the experience, you cannot organize it.
Yes.
And so, actually, have you read Thomas Kuhn? Here's another reference for you.
No.
Thomas Kuhn is the guy who, I believe, he's a guy who invented the word paradigm in the modern scientific sense of paradigm, right? So you've heard.
Oh, wait, actually, I have. I just didn't know he was the author. The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. I've read that.
That's the one. That's the one. Look at Thomas Kuhn. It's Thomas Kuhn. I love it. I mean, this is another one I stumbled into, which was just like, oh my God, you know, this is exactly what I'm saying. He was saying that it's a model. He says, I have this thing with this, which came, I think, was an appendix to his book. It's like something like, I'm talking about a model of understanding, which is, let me find it. Talk about Kuhn so much, I can't. I search for this. Something like a model of understanding, which is misconstrued if it's interpreted as something which is abstracted and thereafter functions in its place.
Yeah.
Which is the same as I'm saying. It's like I'm saying that so paradigm, he originally got it apparently in the Greek. It means examples. Means example.
Okay.
And or a set of examples. And so he's saying that his model of meaning or his model of thought is that it is a set of examples which are organized and can't be abstracted beyond that organization. And also the fact that you've got these paradigm shifts and people can't get from one to the other. So unless you have a body of experience, which is the examples, which is the paradigm of science that you're doing, you cannot organize them in the same way as somebody else.
Yeah.
So what I found with things like philosophy too, is that I will read some philosopher, and it, because it resonates with what I'm already saying, I think if you don't have the experience, you cannot understand what that they're saying, and it's because 100%. Understanding is organizing your experience. If you don't have the experience, you cannot understand.
Yes.
Yeah. So maybe you just need to have more experience of oscillating networks.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe get a ripple tank or something like that and play around with it.
A what? A ripple tank?
Oh, it's just something you do if you study physics. I mean, so you because.
Oh, a ripple tank. Oh my God. I would love this actually.
Yeah, because physicists are looking at oscillations all the time. Yeah. Actually, I mean, this maps to physics, you know.
Yeah,
because...
I recently was watching videos of there's a sheet and there's sand on it, and then sound is different frequencies.
Yeah, I think I saw that too.
Yeah, it's so lovely.
And it forms objects, right?
Yeah, it forms different, very distinct, different shapes based on the frequency that is being played, because it's like that's the. The oscillations of sound waves or something to that effect. So the grains of sand place themselves or move eventually to the place where the sounds are most concentrated or least concentrated. I forget which one.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is exactly it. So now take that and so all the grains of sand are connected in the same way because they're just lumps of sand, right? So you're only getting the sound pattern. But now imagine those lumps of sand had little strings between them.
Correct. Okay.
So some of them were more clumpy than others.
Yeah.
And then, so imagine how that might affect the patterns that emerged.
Yes.
And that's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying that's the exact system that I'm proposing I'm suggesting happens.
This is really cool because this is like my understanding of the my mind, essentially. I just didn't have it framed in this way, had nothing to do with AI, but I was more thinking of it in, like, for me, it feels very like esoteric. I'll describe it and then maybe you can connect it for me.
Okay.
I've seen that, like, the state of love or appreciation is a different vibe than the state of, something like something that blocks the flow of love or is like depreciative. And it's a different, it organizes information differently within my, like the vector space of my mind. So that's where I started to look up the videos of the sand to sort of help myself see the thing I'm seeing in the physical world. I was like, yeah, it's just like that.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, it might be love is one way of organizing it and hate is another way of organizing it. Whatever it's like, it's just different ways of organizing the same information.
Yeah.
And so the information, has to, there's no single way of organizing that information which captures everything. You need to, it's like this, if there's contradictions, and I suppose hate and love, so you need to be able to do both.
Yes.
You can construe the same information. I mean, that's what you see happening in politics all the time. People construe the same thing to mean what they want it to mean.
Yeah.
That's what the postmodernists went on about for a lot. It's exactly the way I'm seeing things working is a vibe. I mean, it's a vibe. Something vibes with your experience vibes together in one way or another way. Exactly, a vibration.
Okay, super cool. This connects significantly with my understanding.
Yeah, I mean, I think it fits in all sorts of ways. It's just a matter of in terms of the nuts and bolts. It'd just be fun to actually sort of marry it with what people have already done with large language models, you know, because I mean, I've been thinking about this for a long time too. I just haven't had I haven't sort of had the polish. The oscillation thing is about 2016. I came to this oscillation idea. So it's kind of contemporary with language models first taking off. It would be nice. I think that people are going to stumble on it eventually. It's just sort of frustrating that it's difficult to get people to jump out of their current paradigm, which is because I suppose it's making billions of dollars for them. I don't know why it would be happening. and try something new and just look at the problem in a different way.
Sure. Cool.
Okay. No, yeah. So good talking. Yes. And,
this was awesome.
Yeah. So, feel free to, let me know what you think of those, riffs or whatever.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you very much, Rob. And, see you around.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye.